This is the BBC.
Hello, I'm Kirsty Young. Thank you for downloading this podcast of Desert Island Discs from BBC Radio 4. For rights reasons, the music choices are shorter than in the radio broadcast. For more information about the programme, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4. My castaway this week is the architect Amanda Levitt. Pushing against the boundaries of conventional design, she applies her creative discipline to everything from department stores to mosques. Plenty bespoke brand new structures, of course, but she's also trusted with the highly nuanced task of giving a contemporary flourish to such establishment shrines as Lord's Cricket Ground and the V&A Museum. Over the years, her work has won her an international reputation and a highly prestigious Stirling Prize for architecture. But her position at the heart of the design establishment is unlikely to have dimmed her unconventional spirit, in evidence even as a teenager. She was asked to leave her well-to-do girls' school for sunbathing naked on the roof of the science block. A little later, she secured her place to study architecture without the requisite maths A-level and in spite of her portfolio not featuring a single drawing of a building. She says of her work, "It's a competitive world. You need to be good at politics, urban planning, art history. It is hugely broad. Every time you begin a project, you enter into a new world. You come out of it changed, enriched." And so welcome, Amanda Levitt. A very demanding project is almost at its end for you, and that is you've been designing this new entrance and courtyard and gallery for the V&A Museum. Very high profile. I'm sure it has been highly demanding. How do you think it has enriched and changed you this time?
Well, this has probably been one of the most exhilarating projects I've ever worked on. To work with an institution like the V&A, where you are working with curators and keepers who know more about their subject than anyone else in the world, is an extraordinary privilege. And there is a slow pace to the museum that I initially felt very frustrated by. But I grew to love and to savour it, because for every move you make, there was forensic questioning as to whether this was the right thing to do. And it's challenging, and it forces you to state the case in a much clearer and more argued way.
To walk through a completed building that you have seen from the beginning of the creative seed that you yourself have had, to then walk through your own building, tell me what that sensation is like.
It is an extraordinary sensation. Having designed a building, having developed the drawings, sometimes I am experiencing the building through the lens of the visual. But I think what you can never get from a drawing is that feeling of being uplifted, of being exhilarated, that feeling of light and volume that changes your mood, that lifts you. And that, I think, you know, for me, that is what I strive for.
Now, I have read that everyone that comes to your architectural practice in North London is at least asked and certainly encouraged to take their shoes off.
That's right.
I'm wondering where you stand on the practicality of spaces.
I don't wear shoes at home. It makes for a more informal atmosphere. It's a great leveller. It strips away a layer. And, you know, when you come into our office and there's this big, messy pile of shoes, it speaks of the individuals in the office, but it also speaks of a sense of common endeavour and collaboration. And that goes to the very heart of the way that we work.
Here was me thinking you just didn't want to get your nice carpet dirty.
Well, it has. That's a side a side benefit.
Let's go then, Amanda Levitt, to your first disc of the morning. Just tell me a bit about this.
My first disc really takes me back to my adolescence. I was a very heady, romantic adolescent, and I wanted to be French. I smoked Dix Bleu, I listened to French music, and I read a lot of French literature. Tous les garçons et les filles de mon âge se promènent dans la rue de Pardieu. Tous les garçons et les filles de mon âge savent
sais bien ce que c'est qu'être heureux. Et les yeux dans les yeux, et la main dans la main, ils s'en vont amoureux, sans peur du lendemain. Oui, mais moi, je vais seul par les rues, l'âme en peine. Oui, mais moi.
Françoise Hardy and Tous les garçons et les filles. Amanda Levitt, public spaces, let's talk about that for a moment. You know, whether they happen to be museums or department stores, they have a central role in our culture. And as our lives become increasingly individualised, I wonder if you can explain to me what role you think civic spaces have in culture right now.
I think there has never been a more important time to create outdoor public spaces, probably more important than buildings, because it's those spaces where relationships are formed, where ideas are exchanged, and that leads to progress. So whenever we are designing a building, when we're given a brief, we will try and take it beyond the confines of the building, creating spaces that belong to the public. So with the Museum of Art, Architecture and Technology in Lisbon.
And that was opened in what?
Which opened in October of last year.
Yes.
Extraordinary site on the waterfront facing south. Absolutely wonderful. The roof is a destination in Lisbon. It is a place that people have assignations. It's a place that joggers run over and under. The success, I think, of the Museum in Lisbon, for me, will be measured as much by the way in which people appropriate the spaces, outdoor spaces that we've created, as much as the museum itself.
By way of contrast, in 2014, you did this little pop-up restaurant. It was a restaurant that only sold tinned fish to its customers. Tell me about that. How did it come about? Well, what was it like? It was called Tin Can.
It was kind of pretty literal. We used to go to Lisbon a lot for site visits, and we came across this tiny restaurant, which was a former fishing tackle shop, that only sold tinned fish. And I just thought the notion of a restaurant without a kitchen is so brilliant. And the tinned fish was wonderful. And we lost a series of competitions. And when you do a competition, it's a massive financial investment. And, you know, you feel very defeated. I thought, you know, this time, let's just do something that would be fun. Why not open a pop-up restaurant selling tinned fish? It said something about who we are. It was entrepreneurial. We ran the restaurant. We sourced the fish. We had endless tastings to get the perfect anchovy, the perfect tuna. It was great.
Let's have some more music, Amanda Levitt. We're going to listen to your second choice of the morning. Tell me a little bit about this.
So this is a piece of music that takes me back to my childhood, growing up in Richmond. A fairly bohemian existence, a little bit chaotic at times. And this is a piece of music that my mother used to play a lot. Hauntingly beautiful. And it made me feel very grown up listening to it.
Bachianas Brasileiras No. 5, performed there by Vittoria de Los Angeles and the French National Orchestra, conducted by the composer Heitor Villa-Lobos. So, Amanda Levitt, as you said, you were brought up in Richmond. You'd been born in Bridgend in the middle of the 50s. You said a bohemian and sometimes chaotic upbringing. Your mother was, she trained as a dancer. Mm-hmm. And indeed, at one point, she had spent some time teaching dance to children who had been affected by thalidomide.
Yes, really extraordinary work. She was very pioneering in the work that she was doing. And then she took dance and other arts into prisons, into institutions that had never been exposed to that kind of influence. She is a very free-spirited woman.
And what was her approach to bringing up her? You were the eldest of three.
I was the eldest. She and my father were very young parents, married when she was 21. And I think they still had a lot of exploring to do. So it was perhaps an absence of parenting, which on one level kind of formed me. It was slightly unconventional.
Give me examples.
Well, I suppose when I made the decision to leave school at 16, neither of my parents thought to challenge me. There was no, you know, I just said I was leaving school and off to art school, and that was that. There was no discussion.
And your father had a pretty conventional job. He was a merchant banker. He'd wanted, though, to be an actor.
He wanted to be an actor, but didn't follow his dream, I think, much to his eternal regret, and then went back into business.
Was your father somebody who, as you were growing up, spoke about the fact that he hadn't pursued his dream?
No, he didn't. I just think that he would have been much happier if he had.
And the amount of freedom that you were given then, did this extend to... I mean, did they tell you what time to go to bed? Did they tell you what clothes were suitable?
Well, certainly not what clothes were suitable. I mean, I do remember going to school in bare feet on one occasion, obviously to try and make a point, and was promptly sent home, which was probably the reason I did it. Another time I went to school with a sheet as a dress. I mean, it was fairly extreme.
And what were you like as a little girl? You know, if you're not being parented in the conventional sense, there's a space there. Who was taking care of that?
Well, I was, you know, being the eldest, my kind of default mode was to look after. And that's what I do still,
right,
to protect my brother and sister.
And how old were they?
Them. My brother is 3 years younger. My sister is 6 years younger. I mean, we were, you know, we were loved. Yeah. And that was very important. But it made me very independent.
Tell me about your next piece of music then. What are we going to hear?
This piece of music is all about liberation, exuberance and independence. I used to listen to this in my room.
Fellas, I'm ready to get up and do my thing.
I would dance in front of the mirror. I would dance at it at parties. I still dance to it at parties. It's a wonderful, wonderful piece.
Can I count it off? One, two, three, four. Get on up, stay on the scene. Get on up, like a sex machine. Get on up, get up, get on up. Get up, get on up, stay on the scene. Get on up, like a sex machine. Get on up, get up, get on up. Stay on the scene. Get on up, like a sex machine. Get on up. Wait a minute, shake your arm, then use your palm.
That was James Brown and Sex Machine. Amanda Levitt, you said that was you dance to it still, but memories for you of dancing as a teenager in your bedroom to that. And you know, most teenagers are characterised by a sort of low-level self-consciousness. The day that you stripped off and lay down to sunbathe on the roof of the science block, well, tell me a bit about that. I mean, what actually happened?
You know, I was a bit of a rebel. It was a very academic school and I didn't want to go to Oxford and Cambridge, and I think quite early on the teachers probably gave up on me and maybe I gave up on them. And I, you know, did what I wanted to do, and it was a beautiful sunny day and it was before we knew that sun was bad for you, and I wanted a suntan all over without marks, and I didn't like biology lessons, so I thought I'd stay on the science block roof. And the chances of being caught were pretty high. And I was just asked, what do you think you're doing?
Did you enjoy creating that disruption?
Yes, I did.
You weren't expelled.
I wasn't. I was asked not to come back after I'd done my O-levels. And I went to see the headmistress and I told her I had absolutely no intention of coming back anyway.
I'm feeling very conscious that I'm coming across as a terribly uptight Presbyterian here, but it's a rather sort of extraordinary thing to have happened, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, this is a long time ago. I'm 61. This happened when I was 16. It's just... Well, when I look back at myself, I think, yeah, that was pretty cool. And, you know, in those days, it was cool to be naughty. Now it's cool to be clever.
You went on then to Hammersmith School of Art. What was it about that that appealed to you?
Well, I just wanted to go to art school. I wanted out of school. I did a foundation and it was a wonderful, wonderful year of exploring my creativity. And I was doing a lot of reading about history of art. And in reading about that, I discovered architecture. And it was a moment of realization because I understood instinctively that there is a kind of built-in resistance with architecture. There are boundaries that are very, very real. And I know myself well enough to know that I work best when I've got something to push against. And I thought that's for me.
And so you applied then to the Architectural Association, but you didn't have a maths A-level and you didn't have any drawings of buildings.
No.
Well, what do you think they saw in you?
I think they saw that I had a certain view of the world, that I had a certain feeling for line, for form. And I think they probably saw that I was quite an independently minded, free-spirited character. And that's what I found so heartening and liberating about going to art school and then to the AA. They're looking at talent, they're looking for passion, and that's what I look for when people come for an interview in my office.
And have you ever felt yourself at a disadvantage in not having your maths A level?
Absolutely not.
That'll be such a comfort to so many people. Right, tell me about your next piece of music then. We are going to listen to your fourth.
This track is for my former husband, Jan. Jan's best friend from Prague trained as an architect and became a rather famous pop star in Czechoslovakia, as it was then. And this is a piece of music that we would listen to. It's a cover version of Bruce Springsteen, sung by Jan's best friend. It's called My Hometown, Moj Rodny Dom. But despite Jan having lived in London for 40 years, his real home was Prague.
Bylo mi 16 let, já znát chtěl svět, náš dům byl jak mříž. Táta jen kýv, řek máš svůj věk, tak pojď chlapče blíž. Do kapsy sáh a dal mi klíč, řek cestu dál poznáš, až poznáš svět a budeš chtít. Kam se vrátit máš, je to tvůj rodný dům.
Můj rodný dům, My Hometown, composed by Bruce Springsteen, sung there by Pavel Bobek. And as you refer to it, Amanda Levitt, there, you were talking about Jan. That was Jan Kaplitsky, an architect who you had met originally, I think, in 1985.
Yep.
What were your initial impressions of him when you met him?
Jan was an immensely tall, very handsome man who had a cult following as an architect. He'd built very little, an extraordinary talent. And he became a great friend. But I thought, you know, this is somebody extraordinary. I always found people who have left their country particularly interesting because it takes such courage, it takes such commitment to do that. Then we went to Prague. He was going to Prague and I thought I'd always wanted to go there. And at that time, there was a frisson, there was something happening. And then when we arrived in Prague, he took us to the house that he had been born in and that he'd lived in until he was 30 when he left in 68. And he stood by a tree that had been planted on the day that he was born, a very beautiful weeping Japanese maple. And that was the moment I fell in love with him.
So he was 18 years your senior. You describe him as this very sort of charismatic, purposeful, talented man. You began a professional partnership too. What was your working relationship like?
At the beginning, our working relationship was really great. I was working for Richard Rogers when I met him, and then I wanted to persuade him to stop teaching and to set up an office, a proper office. And I said that I would leave Richard Rodgers and that we could work together. And those early years of working together were very heady. We had absolutely no money. We never took holidays. We never went out to lunch in case anybody rang and we weren't there to answer the phone. It was just the two of us for a very long time. But we got by, and we got by on very little. But they were happy days.
It sounds as if, I mean, professionally in your life at the time, as you say, you'd been working for Richard Rodgers in his practice in the late 80s. And to remind people, you know, that was, architecturally, that was the hot place to be.
Oh, I mean,
along with Renzo Piano, they had built the iconic Pompidou Centre in the late 70s, 1977. Presumably, if one wanted a job in architecture anywhere in the world, but certainly in London, then that was the place to work.
It was the place to be.
Did it feel like you had given up quite a lot to be sitting, staring at Jan over the desk, wondering if the phone was ever going to ring?
No, I'd always wanted to have my own practice. That had always been my intention. And I'd learned so much from Richard, not just about architecture, but about the importance of creating culture in a place, in an office.
Tell me more about that, about creating a culture that enables people to be their creative best.
The less structure there is, the more the office will look after itself. What it means is that people take huge responsibility. And in taking huge responsibility, you give of yourself in a way that you might not otherwise do. And to create an atmosphere that everybody feels they have a contribution to make, that they will be listened to, and that is fun.
Let's have some more music. Tell me about your next Amanda Levitt. We are on your fifth.
Oh, my next piece is really about fun. I chose this for Josef, who is my son with Jan. And we used to dance to it after breakfast and before school. I think he would have been aged five. And I think, you know, when you work very hard and you're not always there at the school gates, you have to seize your moments.
Was Westlife's version of Uptown Girl. You said that was chosen. I mean, beautiful image you gave us of you and your young son, Josef, as he was then, dancing in the kitchen to that at breakfast time. The media centre at Lord's Cricket Ground, that was completed at the end of the 1990s. That had been born out of the partnership of you and your husband's architectural practice. It was this very sort of radical looking, it was a sort of white pod-like structure on a kind of pedestal thing. Is that a fair description
mm-hmm.
of it?
Yep, I'll settle for that.
You'll settle for that. It went on to win the Sterling Prize for Architecture, and as although there were people who did decry it, many people loved it. They loved its freshness, they loved its radical approach, they loved the actual building itself. Winning the prize, a big architectural prize like that, what difference did it make to your working life?
Oh, first of all, it made a massive difference to us on a very practical level. We were almost bankrupt. It was probably the most technically challenging project I've ever worked on. And we were so focused on it for so many years that I had just forgotten to look for other work. And actually, I assumed that people would come to us and ask us to build media centres around the world. Of course, nothing. And the bank wouldn't lend us any more money. And then we won the Sterling Prize. And I think it was £20,000. And that kept us going for a long time.
And did the jobs come in? Did the phone start to ring more?
Then the phone did start to ring. We got a call from Vittorio Radice, who's then the CEO of Selfridges. And he walked into our really rather sleazy office in Paddington, saw there was kind of a room of four people. Hadn't occurred to me to get extra people sitting at desks.
Or to sort of dress the room. Yeah, yes.
People do that to make the office look bigger than it is. Mm. And you could tell that he thought maybe we weren't of a size to deal with this large project he had in mind for a department store in Birmingham. So I said, let me just take you and your directors around the media centre, then you'll understand the complexity. And, you know, if we can do that, we can do anything. And it was a short competition and we won it. And winning the Sterling Prize and winning the competition for Selfridges happened within a matter of weeks.
Let's have some music, Amanda Levitt. We're going to listen to your sixth of the morning.
This is a piece that reminds me of being in the office, working late. And it also reminds me of how supportive my office were then and how they continue to be. I've always been terrified of flying. I've turned down work in the past because it involved too much travelling. And I was asked to do a project in Venice, and it was something I really wanted to do. And my office bought me a Walkman and thought that it would help me to listen to my favourite piece of music at the time. And this was the piece of music that we would listen to in the office when we were working on a competition.
And did you have it in the headphones as you took off?
I did, and it really helped.
No, senhor, te dizer, pra nós dar-nos próximo, molda-nos mesmo, tão contei feito nesse mundo, pau, tchau, só ingratidão. No, senhor, te dizer, pra nós dar-nos próximo.
Bondade y maldade, kindliness and maliciousness, sung there by Cesária Évora. Tell me a little bit, Amanda Levitt, about this period in your life when it was around about 2003, you had split up with your then husband, but you continued to work together. I get the impression from things that I've read it wasn't an altogether amicable separation, and you have said that that working environment at the time was, well, you've characterised it as highly dysfunctional. What was the problem?
The problem was the lack of communication between Jan and me. We'd had a very public falling out, if you like, and Jan was he was an extraordinary man to whom I owe a huge debt, and without my time with him, I would not be doing what I'm doing now. But he was a very difficult man. And so we had, in effect, a kind of invisible Berlin Wall running down the middle of our sunny office. And he would do his projects and I would do mine. But he would, without invitation, critique my projects and my team, and that was tough.
Ah. Did it resolve itself?
No, we tried very hard, and it was clear to me that it was never going to work. And so I initiated the conversation about splitting the office. I wanted to work in a much more collaborative way, and it seemed the right moment. He had found personal happiness. I had too.
You had remarried in 2007?
Yes, that's right.
And there followed after your remarriage, it seems to me, a sort of tumultuous couple of years.
Well, 2009 was the year that we were going to separate the office formally. We'd been talking with lawyers for 2 years. And Jan had gone back to Prague for the birth of his daughter with his second wife. And I was in Bangkok on a business trip with Ben, my husband. And I had turned off my phone. Very unusual for me. I don't normally turn off my phone. And I woke the next morning to messages to hear of Jan's death. I remember it very clearly, but my focus was just on Josef and getting back to London so that I could tell him. And it was made more difficult because I had not reconciled with Jan. And that is a regret that I will have for the rest of my life.
You did set up your own architectural practice. You have said in the past that that was the only time that you believe that you have experienced a fair degree of misogyny. What form did it take?
What I hadn't expected after Jan's death was that the press would be very antagonistic towards me. You know, Jan was such a revered and loved figure, and I wasn't in that way. But it is the only time that I have felt that. So I felt a great need to prove myself and to prove that I wouldn't fail.
Let's have some more music. Tell me about your next, Amanda Levitt.
This piece of music is really about when I met Ben. The first night that I stayed over, I slept in untypically late. I was in an unfamiliar house and I went down the stairs and I heard this piece of music playing and I smelt breakfast being cooked. And I thought, I think I finally met the person who will look after me.
Ave Maria, performed by Leslie Garrett with Amanda Thompson on piano. Amanda Levitt, as I understand it, principal architects, just over 80% of them are men in the profession generally, which is a pretty sobering figure. In your own architectural practice, what's the balance?
Well, I'm very proud that for the first time our gender balance has just tipped in favour of women. I've never enjoyed working more than I do now. The office has never felt as creative and productive and as happy as it does now. And I think a lot of it is to do with having a very equal gender balance. However, I've never, ever taken someone on just because they were a woman, and I wouldn't do that.
You have great success. You have a very prominent role now in your own profession, and I'm sure you're asked all the time by young design students, architecture students, what your piece of advice is for them in order to carve a successful career too. What do you tell them?
You have to have passion and you have to have incredible tenacity and resilience. And you have to want to hang on to ideas that are fundamental to the vision, but have the humility to abandon an idea or to take a different path if something really isn't working. And that for me is the kind of excitement of architecture. You have to have the confidence to divert.
I don't know if you've imagined your desert island dwelling, but you'll surely have to try to fashion one. What do you think it would look like, Amanda?
Well, I love to be alone, but I love to be alone knowing that people are coming home. I will try and create shade because I don't like to sit in the sun. But I think I'm going to struggle with the idea of being alone without certainty of rescue.
Tell me about your final piece then.
My final piece is a piece of music that my mother bought for me shortly after Josef was born. And it's just a piece of music that I find so complex and hauntingly beautiful.
Bach's Cello Suite No. 1, The Prelude in G Major, played there by Yo-Yo Ma. Amanda, I'm going to give you some books now. I give every castaway the Bible and the complete works of Shakespeare, and they get to take another book along. What's yours going to be?
I'm going to take André Malraux's Museum Without Walls. It kind of anticipated this digital age that we live in without borders. And I kind of want to plot my next move while I'm on the desert island.
We'll give you that. You're allowed a luxury. What's yours going to be?
I'd like a lifetime supply of freshly laundered linen napkins. At every meal, I use napkins and it will help me feel composed. I will catch my fish, I will make a fire, I'll barbecue the fish, and I'll lay it out nicely with the napkin and look out towards the sea.
The civilising influence, then, of freshly laundered napkins are yours. Finally, which one of these tracks would you save?
I will take the Bach cello suite.
It's yours, Amanda Levitt. Thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a download from the BBC. You'll find more information on the Radio 4 website, bbc.co.uk/radio4.
This is the BBC.